So Jewish Women, Dana Eggert and Rhea Lehman interviewing Mr. John Robin on February 15th, 1982. I'm sorry.
Mr. Robin, we continue with your Ford Foundation assignment in East and Central Africa. Here, I assume, as an NDE, you brought your staff of experts along.
Well, they weren't the same experts, obviously, because in India we were dealing essentially with metropolitan urban problems and regional planning problems. In Africa, most of the work was on the national level with the newly established independent governments of what had previously, with the exception of Ethiopia, been British colonies or protectorates. The countries where we had programs were Kenya, where we were based and where I lived, Tanzania, where we had an active program, Uganda, Ethiopia, and Zambia. And in the last part of my tenure there, we established small programs in three other newly independent countries in South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland. Those were minor programs ultimately. The main interest there was to give them some start in life because they're almost overpowered by South Africa, which surrounds them. The work was very pleasant. The communication was in English. And there were still a large number of expatriate, mainly British, former British.
What was the size of your team?
Oh, I guess it varied from 15 to 25. We had a budget of about $6 million. Mm-hmm. Some of that, of course, was spent in grants directly to African institutions, such as Haile Selassie University in Ethiopia and Makerere University in Uganda. And others was the provision of for the upkeep and provenance of the experts we supplied. And we made special grants to the Serengeti Research Institution, which was one of the outstanding ecological research stations in the world, and to other national parks in East Africa.
Did you find the governments of the various areas cooperative?
Yes, they were extremely friendly at that time, and they were still largely dependent, or felt they were still dependent on outside assistance insofar as it could be obtained for them. And their relations with Americans in general, and with our people in particular, were very good. And we had access to President Nyerere in Tanzania, and President Kaunda in Zambia, and I met Emperor Haile Selassie several times, and we had good access to the Ethiopian political and economic and academic structure.
He was an unusual figure, wasn't he?
He was a most unusual man. He was, of course, he came to a tragic end too many years ago. But in a sense, he was the victim of his own good impulses. He wanted to modernize the country, and as often happens, the very people that he sent abroad to study or raised to some proficiency in the armed services in the end decided that they could do it better. And he had a coup on his hands and was ultimately either killed or allowed to die. And the interviews I had with him were relatively formal. I mean, you call it an audience. But I remember with considerable pleasure, because he was a man of history, he's a member of the Ethiopian War, Mussolini, and his appearances before the League of Nations and his reinstitution. Ethiopia is a particularly interesting country because it was the only piece of Africa, with the exception of Liberia, that had never been colonized, and which had an independent Christian culture of its own. It goes back into considerable antiquity. And the people are very different. In each of these countries, the dominant tribe or nationality is very distinct from the others, both within the country and as relates to other parts of Africa on the whole. And the dominant people in Ethiopia under the empire were the Amhara people, who had the same old culture. And the country still remained relatively rural and feudal. And then now what has changed, of course, it has a communist-oriented government, a military government, probably much more cruel and more rigid than the empire's rule was, than the emperor's rule was. And more or less now blocked off, I would think, to at least Western influence. And President Nyerere, President Cohen, our contacts were not on a daily basis, of course, with him, but from time to time, came, he visited, and they talked about the program, found out what they were interested in. And as I say, our work was principally in public administration, agriculture, economic planning and economic development, and various disciplines, and academic disciplines. My predecessor had a particular interest in linguistics, and we had a major program in African languages at that time, too.
You were in Kenya, based in Kenya?
Based in Kenya for 3 years.
And what were your living conditions?
Oh, my living conditions were superb.
They took good care of you.
Yeah, it's something that probably would never establish that standard of living again. I know we never will, and I've never had it before. First, the climate in Nairobi is excellent. It's on the equator, 1 degree south of the equator. It has a moderated climate by its altitude, and you really are living in a place which cannot be bettered, and not yet the victim of any kind of industrial pollution. And within a few miles of the city, you can be in absolutely wild country. And you can change your climate by going up the slopes of Mount Kenya or down the coast of Mombasa. It's a great place to live. We had a very well-organized office. We had a very well-organized household. The foundation provided my house, which was a nice, lovely house, so lovely grounds, competent staff and servants. And the food supply at that time was first class. Kenya had become a good agricultural producer under the British. Milk and butter, good meat, other things were available, and had a free market, all the necessary delicacies or good wines or other things coming in from Europe. So it was a very, very pleasant place to be.
Were your children ever with you in anything?
Not in East Africa. My daughter had been with me in Calcutta.
I see.
By that time, they were grown and had their own career.
I see. Was this superior to the living conditions that you had in India?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's no comparison, really, as far as environment, just climate and environment, and generally a pleasant and uncluttered life as compared to India. In India, you can never be out of reach of people. You can stop on a deserted road somewhere, and all of a sudden it's about 30 people come around looking, find out why are you there, what did you do, we're waiting for you to leave a bottle or some other piece of what we would call trash, which they might recover.
I found Nairobi an extremely clean city. Were the other cities in India or in Africa that you were in similar?
Yeah, the capital cities were always looked after well, and that would be true of Dar es Salaam, which was the capital of Tanzania, and Lusaka, which was the capital of Zambia, and then Entebbe and Memelaps on the capital of Uganda. But at that time, and I'm sure conditions have deteriorated since, obviously, it deteriorated terribly in Uganda. The one place which would have been more like India in the character of its poverty and diseases was Addis Ababa and Ethiopia in general.
Do you think it's because the countries had recently become independent and had a certain pride?
In addition, the infrastructure was still there. It had not time to deteriorate. And the customs and in fact many of the same officials and other people were still in charge, or at least the tradition was still in effect. Since that time, I gather, I haven't been back since 75. I think there's been some deterioration due to population pressure, poverty, insecurity, issues of that kind. That's obviously true of both Ethiopia and Uganda, which have had a breakdown. Very tragic breakdowns.
Did local customs or superstitions impede your work at any point?
Oh no. You were dealing wholly, they might have impeded the work of people in the field.
That's what I meant.
In agriculture or in, but as far as the governing officials were wholly westernized and either European or American educated or gone to African universities with a British, essentially a British standard of achievement. And
the implementation of the program was not there.
No, and none of these countries was religiously dominated by either Muslim or Christian sects. They were all secular governments. and varied, I think, from essentially a free enterprise-oriented government in Kenya to a socialist-oriented government in Tanzania.
And what are the living conditions of the population?
Well, they vary, of course. It's a very small middle class, and the only people with good incomes are usually people in government service. There's a very large gap between the cash income of somebody in a government job as against that of a peasant or a tribesman who are living on annual incomes of less than $100 a year in many cases. But and it varies in the parts of the countries too, and among the various tribes. In Kenya, the Kikuyu tribe is more successful in enterprise than others. In Tanzania, the Chaga tribe lives in a rich area and produces entrepreneurs. There's a whole custom. It's an odd selection. Each African country seems to have one group of people who seem to accommodate better than others. And much of trade in the daily, in regular commerce, not at an international level, but in a local level, was still being handled by the Asians who had come to those countries from India, Pakistan, under the British, and who have been gradually persecuted or not accepted under independence, and whose condition has always been tenuous, although many of them opted for local citizenship. But they were sort of the economic fabric of the country on a mercantile basis. And the international institutions, banking, commerce, and so on, major commerce, were still largely European in character. And so the income gaps were very wide regionally, depending on the relative wealth of the region, depending on which this question is soil, rainfall, and also between people employed in the modern sector of the economy, as against a large majority who are still in the relatively primitive agricultural sector.
Weren't there non-native, tradesmen, the Indians and the Europeans, weren't they forced to take in African partners?
Often, yes. That's the strongest since I left there, but there's been a program. I just recently saw a story about Kenya that the Asians have been asked or told they have to take in African partners or teach Africans how to run their businesses. And it was a conscientious program by the government to supplant both Europeans and Asians with the natives of the country. And this was often unjust to many people because the Asian community had been there for 100 years in many cases, so many of them were Kenya-born, sons and daughters of Kenya-born intent. And so you have a rather tragic refugee problem which came about particularly from Uganda after the turmoil there became so acute under Idi Amin.
Did you encounter any Jewish population?
No, there were, I'm sure, a fair number of Jews, both in among the expatriate people coming to work, having come to work in the country. And there were successful Jewish entrepreneurs. And at that time, just diminished since, Israel had a foreign aid program and an investment program, which was originally well received in Black Africa. But when the Palestinian situation became more acute, ultimately, I guess, that terminated. And I think the Israelis for a while were training the Uganda army, ultimately, obviously to their regret. At least having trained it, they knew how to get around it, as the famous Entebbe rescue shows. And some of the successful businessmen, of course, in Kenya were Jewish, notably the Block family, which owned the New Stanley Hotel and other industries. But I think there was no strong Jewish per se influence or persistent one. My guess would be that the Jewish businessmen in Kenya, whatever number there were, probably had been South African in origin originally and come up to look for business opportunities.
Was the government friendly in their attitude towards them?
Oh, I don't think they, well, as I say, they were very friendly to Israel at that time. And in Kenya, I think that continued. As you know, The Israelis were assisted in the Entebbe rescue by the Kenya government. Kenya is the most liberal, I would say, in its views toward outside influences and toward a free economy than the other countries in East Africa.
You never met Idi Amin?
No, I did not. I met his predecessor, Milton Obote, and who is now his successor once again, who was not an estimable character. I admit that when Obote was overthrown, I said that probably was pretty good. And we didn't know how bad Idi Amin was going to be.
Africa had to be a zoologist's dream.
Oh, yes, I loved it.
You did go on safari.
Oh, yeah. Well, safari literally just means a journey.
Yes.
If you're going downtown, that's a safari. But since we had these programs in the national parks and the three East African countries, I had every legitimate excuse to spend time with the people working there. And when we had, Nairobi is a place where part of your duty is really entertaining the distinguished visitors that you get. It's one of the places people like to go to.
It's a pleasant assignment.
Yeah, so, in addition to that, you find that the trustees of the Ford Foundation or high officers of the Ford Foundation or other people who are coming through will be recommended. So obviously they come to see you and you do your best to show them the good side of the country and the program. So that was fun.
Can you tell us something about your safari experiences did you do a lot of filming?
No, I never take pictures. And I did a lot of observing. And there was no particular adventure involved. Being chased by buffalo or anything like that. Land Rover most of the time. It was very peaceful, safe. The most interesting experience I had personally was in the Masai Mara Reserve, which is in southern Kenya. And this is before I was, a tourist myself. I hooked up with a couple of British officers who were there on leave, and we went out to drag a buffalo which had been shot by the game warden. And the buffalo was blind, and he thought, well, the merciful thing is to shoot it and put it out of its misery. But he wasn't going to waste it. He said, well, we'll give it to the lions. So we towed this carcass of the buffalo behind our Land Rover. As though you were deep sea fishing for bait. For lion. And ultimately, we got about 14 lions ranging from big males to little cubs coming quite close to us. And the young man driving us, one of these British officers, saw our jeep stuck in a warthog excavation. So there we were, unable to move out. And tied with a buffalo tied to us, and all these lions around us. But that was quite exciting, as you can imagine. But one of the game guards who was with us, a very brave man, obviously, got out of the thing and cut the cord, so we no longer were towing the buffalo. And then the guy got the jeep, the Land Rover, started again, so we went off a reasonable distance. The lions enjoyed their 1,200 pounds of meat for the next 2 days. So that was, as I said, but other than the most perhaps the most interesting thing that I did, especially, is also to go up to Richard Leakey's camp on Lake Rudolph, now called Lake Turkana, and spent a good deal, several days up there with Richard, looking at the terrain in which he's made his world-famous discoveries. And I was right, as I think I said to you earlier, I had some role in giving Richard some small grants early on, which helped their establishing. We were very pleased with that.
Did you ever have occasion to do any writing or lecturing on
not really. As I say, first place, there's hundreds of people doing it all the time, and many of them are professional photographers. And the art of the thing really is to come back with good film. And now, as well, if you watch television, recently we saw the flame trees.
Beautiful.
Yes. Made us homesick.
Did it ever tempt you to return to the sciences?
Well, I could be tempted to return to East Africa. But I truly, though, I did enjoy the acquaintance and friendship I had with the scientific community out there. Mm-hmm. And it was a variation from your normal life of government urban problems. I enjoyed that.
Well, you had good background.
Yeah, you had a great place for bird watching. 800 species of birds in Kenya.
Have you had any ongoing contact with this project?
No, that's partly my fault for being a poor correspondent, but on the whole, once you're separated by two continents, and the foundation personnel has changed over once or twice. There's no longer many people at Ford Foundation that were there in my time.
I was going to ask if Ford was still involved.
Yes, they still have an office in Nairobi.
I see.
But each representative tends to have his own views of what the program would be, and headquarters begin to have a view too. So just what they're doing in East Africa now, I don't know.
From 1970,
they've cut back a great deal.
I see. Probably everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere, I guess.
From 1970 to 73, you were a program advisor in the international division based in Athens. I understand you were director of an international survey of urbanization in developing countries.
Yes.
In Latin America, African Asia?
Yeah. That was a survey that the foundation wanted executed to determine whether they would add urbanization to their program as a major area of foundation interest. They had been interested, as you remember, in population, they had been interested in agriculture, they had been interested in government and law. So they were wondering whether they could go into another area. And I was asked to survey the problems of urbanization in the developing countries, which gave me an opportunity to visit most of the Latin American countries, South American countries certainly, and West African countries, which I had not seen before, and places in the Far East, Southeast Asia, such as Bangkok and Jakarta and Singapore. But that came, unfortunately, to nothing because, while the survey was, I think, productive, the foundation decided it could not afford going into a wholly new program area. So that was 2 years well spent from my point of view, but not really productive in the final program to be embarked upon.
But they made a decision based on your...
Well, they would have, I think, accepted our findings to, if there was a problem and things could be done about it. But what they couldn't do was budget sufficient funds to execute the program on a scale which would have been effective.
And so, you traveled rather extensively, I gather, and your staff along.
Well, I have a small staff. There were only three of us involved in that project.
Mm-hmm.
Two of whom had worked in Calcutta with me. And we were based in Athens, which is a place of convenience, really a very nice place to be, but we had no work to do in Greece per se, as an operating base. And that was a pleasant and enlightening experience too. Again, got to see much of the world that I wanted to never have seen. A number of places I want to go back to, probably never will. Some I don't.
No particular observations on the Jewish population over this vast area?
No, that would have not been one of our concerns.
Yes. During your...
I think, as a matter of fact, in the developing countries, I did not get to North Africa, but the Jewish population, as you know, before the Palestine crisis became so acute, there were a lot of Jewish populations in Morocco and Algeria and Egypt and in Yemen. And unfortunately, they all became refugees, or largely did. I don't know how many Jews are left in the former Arab countries. Iraq was another large Jewish settlement. And these are the Sephardic Jews. And they now have immigrated largely to Israel because their opportunities were cut off in their original homelands. And the only in the cities that I visited, there are two, of course, that have major Jewish populations. One is Buenos Aires, where there apparently still is considerable tension of anti-Semitic views in and out of the government. I think there are 400,000 Jews in Buenos Aires. Some relatives of mine whom I've never known, who never know me, I think are living there. and Johannesburg, which has a large church population. But the others would be very thin on the ground indeed.
During your 10 years with Ford, Mr. Robert, were you on hand at the time of any political upheavals in the various countries?
Well, Calcutta, I guess I was in India. I was in India for one of the India-Pakistan wars, which was really not fought on our side. We were in the east, and it was fought in the west in the Punjab. But then we had blackouts in Calcutta, and there was an alarm of an air raid, which didn't take place. And that was the only formal war that I was in. And in East Africa, there'd be an occasional, in Calcutta there'd be occasional street riots, which are sort of endemic really in Calcutta. I was thinking the other day, since I'm on the PAC board, the transit board here, in Calcutta, when you raised the fares, they went out and burned a couple of trolleys. Of course, that diminished their service because every time they burned a trolley, there was one less. But that was traditional means of protest. But Calcutta had a turbulence, but as far as I know, no American or European was ever hurt by anything that happened. And the period of terrorism, which has occurred, which we now have, where Americans of any kind of stature might be attacked or kidnapped, was then not in effect or even thought of as risk anywhere.
In retrospect,
I was accused, and our mission was accused in India by one of the left-wing papers of being a CIA operation, which of course you could expect. And I wanted to sue them, but I wasn't allowed to. On that point, at no time did I ever have any CIA involvement. The Foundation had a definite agreement with the CIA. There'd be no attempt to penetrate. But that was never a problem for us. You got to know the American ambassadors, of course, or the consul general, obviously where you worked, but we were not a governmental agency or a government related.
In retrospect, how do you evaluate your Ford Foundation experiences, their impact and accomplishments?
Well, I think that I've always felt that the major gainer was me. I had 10 years of very interesting travel, meetings, experiences, thought that otherwise I wouldn't have had in my life. But I've become reasonably skeptical of the permanent achievement of international assistance, except in perhaps agriculture, where it becomes a material thing of developing a new strain of wheat or of corn or something, which is easily transferable. But the attempt to impose, even in the most friendly fashion, one set of values, ours, into an alien society is not likely to normally succeed. And while your work and the political turbulence and the economic difficulties in most of these countries creates kind of impermanence, and the people you deal with are suddenly or subsequently evicted or executed or regimes change and constitutions are torn up. It's hard to see a permanent value in many of the things I think that we did, except where we affected personalities. Like in many cases, people were educated and had their own lives altered by the foundation contacts made on their behalf. And many of them have been, I think, important factors, possibly more in the international field than in their home countries.